Hey, it's Elvis Mitchell. You know me. I host the treatment here at KCRW. Stand by. We're going to start the podcast in about 5 seconds from now. But let me ask you your support because, hey, you know you're listening. I know you're listening because you can hear my voice. Why are you holding on to that money? You're just going to go waste it at Starbucks anyway. We do original programming here. We get the best people who come to talk to you and to me. So send us a few bucks. In fact, send us 10 bucks by texting KCRW to the number 20222. Right? You got that? All right. Here we go. In 3, 2, 1.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, writer-director Will Slocum, has made his first film, an interesting romantic comedy melodrama called Cold Turkey with quite an impressive cast. Will, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, great to be here, Elvis. Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you here. Yeah. And the movie plays around with a lot of things. I mean, it starts off as one thing. In fact, it has kind of a short story feel. Is that what you were looking for with it?
Yeah, that's interesting you say. I mean, like, you know, it's based on, given that it's an indie, given that we didn't have a lot of money, given that we got to be in one location, there are long dialogue scenes, and you have to break it up a bit. And we, one of the tricks was we set the whole movie around three meals, because, you know, it's a family dramedy. And I feel like often, I don't know if this is true with your family, but I know with my family, the only thing it's okay to talk about is, like, meals. Like, when are we going to eat? What are we going to get for dinner? Like, what do you like? What do I like? I'll cook. No, I'll do the dishes. And then once you sit down, you can't get up. Like, you have to sit down, and you have to talk, and you have to behave yourself.
That sounds almost like the classic thing of you're making an indie film with not a lot of money. How do you maximize your resources?
Yeah.
So that was the puzzle you set for yourself to solve, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I knew I needed to write something that was basically all in one location. I knew I needed to have the story be contained, so it takes place over the course of 3 days. I knew it had to rely on actors and rely on dialogue. And given all that, again, I think it's broken up in a funny way that maybe is this short story thing you're talking about. I'm not sure. I never really thought of it like that. But
no, reason I say that because in textual terms, it takes a while to get to what the heart of the story is because you're building up character stuff,
right?
And
that
gives it more of a literary feel than a film feel to
me. Oh, wow, thanks, Elvis. I mean, it is one of those things where, again, when you're with your family, you can't talk about what's actually going on. I really wanted to create this surface tension in the movie where people are like dancing around what they're actually thinking and being very polite, and the music is very proper, and there are these very slow dolly shots around these meals just so everything makes sure that nothing goes wrong. But then, of course, the thing is punctured. Yeah.
But no, it even starts off with the flashback stuff, which those are centered around meals as well. They're centered around birthday cakes.
That's really, I never thought about that. See, this is why you're you, Elvis, and, you know, I'm just a schmo with the movie.
But the schmo I'm talking to is Will Slocum, whose first film as writer-director is Cold Turkey. But so that wasn't a conscious thing to sort of set it up by dealing with food in the flashbacks.
That is so, I never thought of that. No, again, I do think maybe just subconsciously, like, you know, family is, a lot of family situations are built around meals. A lot of family situations are built around coming together, sitting down, turn off the friggin' TV, turn off your computer, we're gonna eat. I know in my family, we ate dinner together. That was a point that my parents made that no matter how late it was, no matter what else is going on in anyone else's lives, we're going to sit down and we're going to eat dinner.
And that was also the kind of the social contract. So you guys could talk about your day. Your parents made sure you did that. So you had dinner together. That's what it was about.
Yeah. And to be honest, I really appreciated that about them. They had tough jobs and they came home pretty late at night, but they always made a point about sitting down and eating together. And I know, you know, my dad would make me breakfast. I don't believe I'm telling you all this. You're so good at your job. This is insane. So I've never talked about this. So my dad would get up and make me breakfast. And I do think with, you know, fathers and sons and families, that's really a way to come together and to agree on something. So what I was trying to do in the movie was subvert all that a little bit. Like, you know, we're supposed to sit down and eat together and have a nice time and talk about our day. But what if we can't talk about what we actually are supposed to talk about or what we feel or that I love you, you know, things like that.
Especially when you're dealing with splintered families. Mm-hmm. And there's always this kind of interesting tension that happens around the holidays when adult children come home.
Right.
And they're not sure if they're supposed to act like adults or children, which is a big part of what's going on in cold turkey as well, isn't it?
I revert to what I was when I left the house, which is an angry, hormonal, you know, little S 18-year-old. And everything's suddenly really dramatic and everything is awful and everything's going wrong. And I don't know what that is. I guess you're just frozen in time or you're frozen in whatever trauma, not that anything bad happened, but just in the trauma of being an angry teenager. And I think it doesn't matter how old you are, that always happens. And you know, what's really interesting, I don't know what it's like for parents when the kid comes. Like, do they react as they did when they were 40 something or 50 something, like when the kid left? Like, I don't know. Or do they react how they think of the kid as like a baby? Like, I don't know. I don't know how that stuff works.
So what is interesting about cold turkey to me is that just in the watching of it, it's obvious that when the kids are frozen this moment when they left home.
Right.
The point where they left the house is the thing that they bring back to the house.
Right.
And what the parents are is just trying to be the best version of themselves.
Mm, interesting.
I mean, that seems to be the difference in me, the way you've written. They're trying to be these ideal versions of themselves and trying to deflect tension in a way that, you know, parents often don't when they're teenagers in the house. You kind of let them just kind of go off or tell them to stop. And those tensions are finally sort of dealt with in the last act of the film rather than the beginning. And there are these, because I'm glad you brought the dinner, so because there's certainly food everywhere, but there's also at some point almost everybody has a drink in their hand, which is, how best to put this, a social lubricant
or a social shield or a social deflector.
But how conscious were you clearly that was something you wanted to do, where everybody at some point has a glass in his or her hand.
I mean, and specifically the Poppy character, the patriarch of the family, the Peter Bogdanovich character in the film, he doesn't want to deal with all this stuff. I think his wife, his second wife, puts on a good face for everyone.
And she's played by Cheryl Hines.
Played by Cheryl Hines, I think is what you're talking about. You know, I think she feels this responsibility to try to make everything go okay. Whereas the Poppy character, Peter, he's okay just to let his eyes glaze over and have another glass of white wine and maybe get his head stuck in a book and not really deal with anything. And, you know, obviously the point of the movie is that at some point he does have to deal with it. And, you know, it may take his daughter stabbing his wife with a fork at the dinner table, but at some point he's going to have to deal with it.
I don't think may is a word you want to use there. It does kind of take that. But and also, too, this is the point we should tell the audience a little bit what the movie's about, which I say is available now on VOD and iTunes.
That's right. So the movie is about a long-lost black sheep sister, played by the brilliant Alicia Witt, who finally comes home for a Thanksgiving. She hasn't been home in 15 years. And we don't really know why she hasn't been home or how or who or what or where. And she's from the Poppy character, Peter Bogdanovich.
It's his first marriage.
Two daughters from the first marriage, one son from the second. And it's these three kids and this one father coming together in this little house in Pasadena.
Where he lives with his second wife.
He lives with his second wife, trying to work out all their issues, basically.
The other thing, too, and I wondered if you went to a lot of theater as a kid, because there's a lot of the kind of tension you get from being in the room. And I understand certainly it's a part of using, again, the tools that you have as an indie filmmaker.
Right.
But there's so much about those rooms
and
about how much smaller those rooms get as there are more people and more tension.
That's really interesting. I mean, I do know very specifically. I went to a production of August Osage County maybe 3 or 4 years ago, the Tracy Letts Pulitzer Prize winning play. And I went with my parents. And I went.
What was that like? Because that's a lot of sort of tension being unleashed between parents and kids in Osage County.
It was great. I mean, you know, my parents loved the theater. I always went to like Gilbert and Sullivan with my parents, and my mom loves like, you know, 40s and 50s musicals. I used to go up to New York with like her and her mom, and we'd go to the theater. So yeah, no, I grew up with that. But specifically August Osage County, there's this one scene towards the end of the second act, as it is in Cold Turkey, where they all sit down for this family meal. And it's one of the best written scenes I've ever seen in my life. You know, theater, movies, books, whatever. This 20-minute just tour de force that, of course, dissolves into complete chaos. But I do remember watching that and saying, that's a good idea for an indie movie. If I could build an entire indie movie around that one scene, maybe we could get away with it.
So. I was moving towards that, but because that, and also, as in Cold Turkey, when that scene is over, you kind of don't know where to look.
Right, right. And that's the other thing I love about Osage County is it forces you to sit in that seat for another, I don't know, at least half hour, maybe 45 minutes, when people come back and they're damaged and they're shattered and it's not, they're not keeping the ball up in the air anymore. Everything's out on the table. Now they got to deal with each other. And I know that's something I wanted to build in as well. There's this scene at the end where the Peter Bogdanovich character is sitting on one side of the room and his three kids are on the other. All the spouses have left. There's no more buffers.
No friends, none of the grandkids around.
No one. And they just got to sit and they got to deal with each other and they got to talk. And that's the place I wanted to get to in the movie. After that, the second wife character, the Cheryl Hines character, asked them to deal with what they just dealt with, which is a whole nother trip. But I didn't want to just end on a huge climax, on a huge stab. I wanted to have everyone come back together and have to talk about what just happened as well.
I wondered, in terms of the casting, how you talked to the actors about what you wanted from them, how many people you saw. Talk about that a little bit, if you would.
What was so great about writing a family movie and directing a family movie was that everyone's got a family. So the first thing I would do when I talk to these folks is ask about their family. And I would talk about mine. They'd talk about theirs. We'd talk about each other's as it related to the script. And it immediately broke any sort of hierarchy or any sort of tension or any sort of pressure. And we were just two people talking about our families. I think that was incredibly helpful. It personalized everything. It meant that they trusted me because it felt real to them and they knew I was doing it from a personal place, which I think they responded to. And even someone like Peter, I remember with Peter Bogdanovich, the first time I talked to him was an hour long phone call. And, you know, hearing this Peter Bogdanovich voice saying, "Hello, Will, I enjoyed your script." You know, it was a complete trip for me. It was nuts. But after that moment, we started talking about his dad and we started talking about his daughters and, you know, it immediately broke this tension, and that was helpful.
Because everybody has these family things that they will talk about with you. They'll talk one-on-one, but they won't talk about in a group.
Right.
You want to bring those kinds of undercurrents and secrets into it. So did you have a table read? You basically sort of said to everybody, "Listen, we're going to be a family here, mm-hmm. and I want you to feel safe in opening these things up." Is that what you did?
That's so interesting as well, because having had these incredibly intense dinners or phone calls or lunches with each actor individually, never talked about it again in the group as a group of actors and as a director. It wasn't like, "Oh, when Peter told me this one thing, and then when Ashton told me this one thing," it was like, no. I had a bond. I had a shared group of secrets with each of them individually. And then together we were creating this, again, this surface tension. Now, in terms of us being all a family together, it's kind of this indie movie thing where we were stuck all in this one house. Cheryl always tells a story about seven actors being on this bed together in the bedroom. She was like, you know, writing some piece for the Huffington Post, and like someone else was like on a guitar, and like they were like telling stories, and it was like summer camp, and they got to know each other whether they liked it or not, and I think that helped the feel of it for sure, the family feel.
How long was the shoot?
12 days.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's a lot of dialogue.
I know. I felt so bad for Peter. He had to memorize all this, because he had to keep saying like "sorry" or "but," because there's a lot of like ping-ponging dialogue. "Stop," "don't," "wait," "if," and it's very, very, very quick, and it's, you know, goes on for 10 pages. So I think he struggled with that a little bit.
Well, if anybody should understand what it's like to get those kind of comic rhythms, it's Peter Bogdanovich, the director of What's Up, Doc. I'm sure he just didn't have to have his actors do it in 12 days.
I know. I think he was impressed by the speed of it, and he was worried as well about the speed of it. But to me, honestly, I liked working that fast because it added the energy and it added the ticking clock. We didn't have time to mess around. We didn't have time to talk. We just had to do it, and it had to be intense, and it had to be fraught with some sort of anxiety. So I liked that.
And it seems almost that kind of pressure cooker situation lends itself to this, because you're dealing with people who know each other but in effect are strangers because they're keeping so much stuff from each other.
Right.
So the fact that these actors probably didn't know each other that well,
right,
it lent itself to what you wanted from them anyway, did it not?
Oh, totally. And, you know, we shot in sequence. I was very careful about doing that as a way to get better performances. You shoot most movies totally out of sequence. And we did some stuff here that was all over the place. But in general, when they got to set, they were early in the shoot, they were shooting scenes early in the movie. And at the end of the shoot, they were shooting scenes late in the movie. So that big breakdown at the end with Peter and the three kids, that was the second to last day. The big Thanksgiving scene was the third to last day. And I think that really contributed to the arc of it as well, or hopefully it did.
Also, too, because you can sort of sense a kind of exhaustion in them, which is a literal exhaustion from shooting, yeah. But also the characters would be worn out from that kind of fighting anyway. Yeah. So that, again, all these real-life circumstances, it seems to me like a pretty ingenious way to sort of use your limitations to your advantage.
No, well, thanks, Elvis. I mean, I know the one scene that always it made me sob in the audition rooms.
Sure, like, which was that?
The scene where the Jacob character confronts the Nina character.
Played by
Ashton Holmes.
Right. And Nina played by
Alicia Witt. Right. And you know the movie's sort of autobiographical, and I share some similarities with the Jacob character. And I remember being in the audition rooms and just like sobbing. I'd be like, "Hi, I'm Will. Great to meet you." And I was so embarrassed. But, you know, we shot that on the last day because it's so late in the movie, as we're talking about. And I remember just even we did it in two or three takes. And Alicia is just mind-blowing in it, as is Ashton. And I remember again starting to cry because we were on set and all the exhaust. You know, we worked so hard. And so, yeah, that was just funny.
We'll take a break. My guest, who has antifreeze in his veins, is Will Slocum. He's the writer-director of the feature film debut, Cold Turkey. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My tough-knuckled guest is Will Slocum, the writer-director of his feature film debut, Cold Turkey, which is playing in theaters around the country, city by city, but it's also available on iTunes and Amazon,
Google Play, Xbox, which I know you're into.
And my guest, who's directed me, by the way, is Will Slocum. But you were talking before about going to plays with your mom and your grandmother.
Yeah.
And I want to know what that experience is like, because there is a sense of kind of real comfort that Jacob has with his mother.
Mm.
And I wonder how much of that is you, because you talked about the autobiographical stuff. And there's clearly sort of a way that there's certain experiences that he's able to talk about as compared to other things. And
for sure. I mean, it's always been interesting. My dad had two kids from an earlier marriage, and then he had me. And that was always a relationship I had with both my two sisters and my dad, but then I'm my mom's only son. So in this one context, I'm a total mama's boy and, you know, I'm very only childish and it's this very, very close and infantile in some ways, I suppose, bond. But then with my dad's side, it can be much more careful and much more, there's just more of a past there. And there's, I guess, less of an innocence. But I remember part of the mama's boy in me going up to New York with my mom and my grandmother. And they're you know, my grandmother was this great old Jewish lady who lived on the Upper West Side or something like that. And in this old apartment, just chain smoking. And she was like a fashion designer in the 70s. And
no kidding. What kind of stuff did she do?
So the label was called Allison Ayers. I think they're still around. If you're on eBay, Google Allison Ayers on eBay. I think there's some still around. And there were these fabulous 70s dresses that she would make with her husband Seymour. And it was just all part of this New York culture, which I'm definitely not a part of. I'm from D.C., which is very conservative.
And small, especially a small town.
It's a small, it's a small southern town. As John F. Kennedy said, it has the charms of the North and the efficiency of the South.
Right? Yeah,
exactly. It's a small southern town. But anyway, going from there and taking the train up to New York, and then suddenly being this cultural explosion, and seeing all my mom's family, and this my like fabulous grandmother with the mink coats and the cigarettes, and we'd go to the play, and the theater was part of that, you know, it made me feel a connection to an earlier era. It made me feel a connection to my mother and my grandmother. That was really important to me, for sure.
I ask you this because there's a kind of theatricality in some of the characters. I mean, Nicholas Coster and his wife, played by Victoria Tennant, when they come in, there's that sense of them being these bigger-than-life characters, right. Bigger than anybody else in the house, as a matter of fact.
Right.
And then there's an almost affected way in which they talk, uh-huh. And the way they deal with their experiences.
Uh-huh.
That feels like somebody in the presence in your life that you're bringing into that.
That's interesting. You know, I don't want to get too specific, but there are a couple folks from my dad's life that I drew on for those two characters. Now, I don't want to say that anything bad happened with my dad and any of their wives or anything like that. I really don't. But there's an amalgamation of a few folks from real life, for sure.
My guess, who's trying to steer clear of the statute of limitations on certain acts, is Will Slocum. His first film as writer-director is Cold Turkey. But I guess I too was asking you about your mom and your grandmother because you obviously have an affinity just in the short stuff you've done for the webisodes online and in this film for some bigger-than-life personalities and the way they collide with people who don't have the same kind of assurance.
Mm. Yeah, honestly, I think that's again, this is crazy. We're talking about my family so much. It's not, but in the way we are, it's crazy. My mother's Jewish, and my dad's from Erie, Pennsylvania. And I've always felt this weird bifurcation between the Jewish side of my family and the more like WASPy side of my family, or Midwestern white side of my family. And I think there's a tendency on the Jewish side to, you know, be very loud and very open, very, very explosive almost, and say what you're always thinking, and it's okay, and we all love each other, and it's fine. The woman to whom I'm related by marriage is a little bit like that, which is great. That's why I love her. And on my dad's side, it's much more careful. And it's much more proper and polite, and there's a certain tone you're supposed to take.
Is your dad a professor as well?
He's not a professor. He could have been. He certainly did well enough in school, but he worked in the Pentagon for a bunch of years, and he's a foreign policy expert.
Which is why, I guess, Peter's character is also a foreign policy expert, who, by the way, was wrong about Iraq, but that's a whole other conversation.
A whole other conversation. My dad would be happy to argue with you about Iraq. So anyway, I don't think it's one-to-one reflected in the film, like, oh, the Deborah character is really loud and explosive and Jewish, and the Peter, you know, quite the opposite, and the Peter character is very soft and polite.
But it's more like the daughters are, especially Alicia Witt's
exactly.
character.
Exactly. It's just this this meeting of two ways of dealing with
and two clashing family. Emotional cultures as mm-hmm. well, and two very different kinds of emotional intelligences at play.
Exactly.
Trying to sort of like maintain their own supremacy
or emotional stupidities, you know.
Well, that too. But I guess I just saw there's definitely culture clash in this piece. I've seen it, and certainly the stuff that your webisodes. And I just it feels like there's this undercurrent of this that fascinates you that you're playing out.
There is, and you know, there act to be honest, there is one. My sister in real life, you know, she says what's on her mind, and from my dad's side, which I love her for, and I'm grateful to her for, and it's one of the reasons that she's just so charismatic and funny. And I just wanted to capture that. I think that's always interesting when you throw that explosive personality into this very staid, calm situation.
Because we see that when Nina enters her house. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, mm-hmm. again, that feels, that's in fact very kind of Osage County almost. That sister walking in and basically lighting every fuse that she comes into contact
with glee, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, the fact that she's got the punkish died in front of uh-huh. she's a little bit too old for
uh-huh.
and all
yep.
these very interesting textures there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, and the, like the leopard print like bra, which was Alicia. That's what Alicia wanted, to get her hair pink and her fingernails purple. I remember she wanted like to chip them very slightly, very, very specific. And then I remember we put this coat on her, which my sister, exactly the kind of coat my sister would have worn. You know, it's actually, I felt like I was cheating a lot as a director.
Why do you say that?
Just because I would be like, oh, well, what sweater do I wear every day? Jacob, that's the one. What coat does my sister wear? Nina, that's, I didn't have to work that hard to figure out the costumes and things like that. But no, I'm glad you noticed the pink hair. I know Alicia was very proud of it.
You can't help but notice all those things. And again, it feels like the kind of, that's why I'm saying these things where somebody's really kind of bigger than life mm-hmm. kind of walks in mm-hmm. and people either love it or tread lightly. And I love the fact that her nephews just love her, much to the consternation of her sister. And they're clearly things that you're playing on.
I mean, part of what you're getting at, which I think is totally on the money, is that, she's a teenager a bit.
She's a big kid.
Yeah, and she gets along great with kids and maybe not so great with other folks. And she can't help it. That's just her. But I do think there is part of that trauma in there and part of that being frozen and obviously in this one adolescent moment.
In fact, not to give too much away, but the trauma that kind of arrests her at a certain age, at the age, in fact, she still acts, right, is key to the story. It's the treatment. My guest, who's not wearing any of his grandmother's clothes sitting across from me, is Will Slocum. His first film as writer-director is Cold Turkey. But I wondered, too, how much you talked to Peter about his very deliberate way of speaking and speaking very, very slowly and after a while being kind of infuriating to some of the family members. How much you worked out with him?
Well, again, in the script, there were all these parentheticals that was like, Poppy, ignoring, or Poppy, borderline interrupting. He's just out of it. He's out of it. And it's not even the white wine. It's just that he doesn't want to deal. And I think Peter really, really grasped that and loved that and found the humor in that. And he's just in his own little world. And part of that being in your own little world is just talking at your own pace, letting the world come to you, sitting there, not really moving too much. Not your face is just kind of what your face is going to be. And really embracing that. And again, I think it's funny and sad, but I think Peter did as well.
I guess what's so... got to be curious about this for you is the idea of directing a director.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What was that like?
There were moments that were a little tricky, for sure, especially early in the shoot. Peter would always say to me, he'd go, you're not going to use that, like various shots. And I would have to say...
And you would say the director of Long Last Love has asked me what I'm going to use?
Oh, boy.
If my guest is blushing across from me, so this is worth it alone. He may be wearing his grandmother's clothes, but he's just as vulnerable right now anyway.
Peter told me a great story about Long Last Love, actually. He, he'd gotten great reviews early in his career for Paper Moon and for Last Picture Show, and he made this movie, Long Last Love. Did not get good reviews. There was a review, I think it was in the Village Voice or something, the headline was, At Long Last Lousy. So he goes to the premiere, he goes to the big party, and the critic, the guy who wrote it, is there.
Was it Andrew Saris?
It might have been. I'm not sure. I should know. It might have been Andrew Saris. And Peter goes. Peter tries to avoid him. Doesn't want to look at him. Doesn't want to talk to him. But the critic comes up and he says, "Mr. Bogdanovich, Peter, I'm so, just so you know, I'm so sorry. I did not write that headline." And Peter looks at him very, very steady, very deadpan. He says, "Yeah, you wrote the rest of it, didn't you?" Which I think is great. I think At Long Last Lousy and At Long Last Love was not a high point for Peter. What was the question? Sorry.
How do you direct Peter Bogdanovich?
That's why
I have this big stack of index cards sitting here right in front of me. As you can see, Will can't even see my face. There's so much stuff written down in front of me.
That's right. the directing the director thing, again, it was tricky in the beginning. But to his immense credit, he said on the phone the first time we talked, he said, just so you know, when I'm acting, I just want to be an actor. I don't want to be a director. I just find that it gets in the way when I start thinking about the lenses and the shots. And I'll just let you do what you want to do. Now, again, there were some tricky moments. But I think after the first few days, we got into a rhythm. And he loved the script, which I think really, really, really helped and gave me a huge leg up in terms of being able to tell him what to do and where to stand and how to walk and where to walk. So that was a help for sure.
Did you know you wanted him? Or were you thinking, did you have an archetype in mind for this? Or did you know you really wanted him once you had the script completed?
The three things I knew I wanted for the character were, one, the character of Poppy, played by Peter Bogdanovich, was, one, he had to be an authority. He had to have either a physical presence or just some kind of strength. Because I think the movie really is about watching this hero become just a guy, watching this arc of seeing your father fall, basically. So he needed to start as a huge authority. That was the first thing. Second thing, he needed to have an intellectual heft. I mean, he's a professor. We needed to believe he was a genius. And we needed to sort of believe that he used some of his intellectualism to shield some emotional stuff, that he was very smart intellectually, but maybe not so smart emotionally. So I wanted that. And the third was that he needed to have some history with women. There needed to be some sort of past there. And I thought Peter Bogdanovich fit all three of those bills quite nicely. And, you know, I would see him on talk shows. I saw him on, like Charlie Rose. And he just had this presence, this larger than life, but letting everything come to him, but very deadpan, very funny in his own little way. And I don't mean the Orson Welles impressions and all that, which is cool, but I just mean these little quips and these little eye moves, and everything was in this guy's face. And he's a ham, you know. Speaking of Jewish musicals, he would be singing show tunes between takes. Swear to God. He'd had a joke for everything. There was always a Jewish show tune. He would be speaking Yiddish between takes. I mean, he's a funny guy. He's like a hip, funny guy. And I thought to inject that into this like heavy family drama, which I didn't really want it to be, would help lighten it a little bit.
I got to say, one of my favorite moments in the film is there's a very long shot in which Missy, Jacob's wife, walks through.
You were really good. Yeah, Missy. That's the character's name.
I saw the movie. See how this works? We follow her walking from the house to the outside, and it's almost like you're making her the audience surrogate, that she's the one outsider who's walking through. And we see her walk from the house to the outside area where there are a group of family and old friends there, and she really feels like the outsider in that moment. Talk a little bit about that, because that's a pretty interesting thing, and I wonder what it was like on the page as compared to shooting it.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because there, you know, again, it was an indie, didn't have a lot of money, we're in one place, 12 days to shoot, but two things I really wanted was I wanted a dolly around the table. I wanted to get that, you know, I love camera movement, and I wanted to see if we get that. And then also, I wanted Steadicam shots. I wanted to see if I could get away, not saying it's like a Boogie Nights style, I Am Cuba style, into the pool and back out, but I wanted to play a little bit, and I wanted to get a cool shot off, and I wanted it. I wanted a big Steadicam shot. Now, how to motivate that in the script and what you're talking about, I purposely built those two Steadicam shots, there are two in the movie, around secondary characters, around folks who aren't from the house.
We're outsiders.
And I wanted to see the house and see the environment from their point of view. The first is Hank, who's Nina's boyfriend. There's a shot where he plays with the kids. Then he packs some of his dip, and he's walking through the house, and everything's carefree. And then the second is with the Missy character. So I wanted to get a sense of place, and I thought the best way to do that was through an outsider. And I wanted to, frankly, give them more screen time. Like, I wanted it to feel like an ensemble, and I wanted it to feel big and messy, and like even these folks who didn't have a ton of lines, but who are, to me, completely essential to the movie, that they got their due. So I'm glad you noticed the Steadicam shot with Missy.
Well, talk about casting her. I mean, talk about casting her and Hank and the actors who played them.
Well, what's funny about those two parts is that if you have a 20-something role and you throw it into the agency system, suddenly it's just floods of like, well, this kid's going to be the next, and he was on this, and like this TV show's about to pop. Those two roles, I swear to God, like nothing else, we just got pounded with submissions, which was funny because, again, like they're not leading roles. In my mind, they're incredibly important, but, you know, there's not a lot of lines. So we eventually found Wilson through our brilliant casting director, Paul Reddy, who had known Wilson for a bunch of years, Bethel, who's on a show called Heart of Dixie right now. Is great. Actually, I had dinner with him last night. He's doing well. And then we found Missy, again, through our casting director, this actress named Amy Ferguson, who is just so beautiful. I really think she's stunning. And she just had this look. I didn't want like a normal looking blonde girl or something like that. Amy was a model. I mean, she has this real presence and this real charisma. And I wanted Missy to look different.
But you also want, clearly, I mean, because there's confidence in Hank because he and Nina are kind of on the same level. They're basically both kids.
Yep.
But Missy is kind of sort of the conscience in her relationship with Jacob. And she's like this straight, she's a person who keeps the marriage together.
You know what's so interesting is that the very first draft of the screenplay, the whole thing was through Missy's perspective. It was a whole VO, a voiceover, where she was writing this letter to her dad back home. She's like, I just spent the craziest Thanksgiving of my life. I'm writing this from a hotel room. They kicked me out. I can't deal with anyone. And we had to cut it. And it didn't, you know, it eventually didn't work. But I think that that feeling was still there of her being the, both of them being the conscience and the outsiders, and having some objective perspective on what, you know, what these people are actually doing. There's this one scene where Peter walks in, having been somewhere, and very drunk at the day before Thanksgiving, and Hank is in the kitchen alone. He's just having a beer, and Peter looks at him, and he looks at Peter, and just don't say anything, and just because Peter doesn't want to deal, and he thinks he's better than this guy or whatever. He just walks out, and Wilson gave this great reaction. I was like, oh my, where am I? What is going on? Who are these people? And I thought that was important to have in the movie, to call people on their BS a little bit.
I got to ask you before we go, last question here.
Yeah.
What was it like when your family saw the movie? The second blush in less than 30 minutes. I'm doing my job today.
Yeah, there were some mixed reviews. You know, what's funny is the Nina character, my sister Marin, like, loved it. She thought it was great. She thought it was fantastic. She's like, you know, she's like, yeah, if you're going to make a parody of me, that's pretty much what it's going to look like. So that was nice. You know, it's been tricky, and it's been interesting. I'm happy I wrote it, and I'm not to get things off my chest just because it was honest, you know. But I think everyone's eventually come around and has been supportive, and God love them. And, you know, I love them, and I'm thrilled that I'm their kid and their brother.
I'm sure they like the movie. Will, we're out of time. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks, all of us. I really appreciate it.
My guest, with whom I work at Film Independent at LACMA, is writer-director Will Slocum, whose feature debut is Cold Turkey. The show is recorded and mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I work at LACMA. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.